This is Ahval Online, meeting point of accurate news and free comment on the current affairs of Turkey. Welcome to our podcast series.
Hello and welcome to Talking Turkey. I'm your host, Ahval editor David Lapesca, and with me today is Richard Giragosian, founding director of the Regional Studies Center and independent think tank based in Yerevan, Armenia. Hello, Richard, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
You are welcome. We are speaking on Monday, July 27, about 2 weeks after violence erupted on the border between Armenia, which is about 95% Christian, and Azerbaijan, which is about 97% Muslim. These two neighbors have been battling for decades, as you well know, over the disputed region of Nagorno-Karabakh, which is internationally recognized as part of Azerbaijan, but overseen by the so-called Republic of Artsakh, a de facto independent state with an ethnic Armenian majority. About 15 days ago, as I said, Azeri troops, so go some of the reports, attempted to penetrate into Armenia proper, looking to take a strategic hill in the province of Tavush, where Armenian troops were stationed. The cross-border skirmishes escalated, leading to a handful of troops killed on both sides, as well as at least one Armenian civilian. Yet neither side gained any advantage. And then another Azeri attempt to take the hill last week also failed, and clashes have continued. And I heard reports this morning that another Armenian soldier was just killed today. Predictably, both sides have blamed the other for the border flare-up. And before we get to the possible role of regional powers, Richard, please, if you would provide us some context on what's happening along the Azeri-Armenian border, what does it mean to you that this skirmish is not happening in the Nagorno-Karabakh region, and how real is the threat of all-out war?
Well, on the one hand, every year, summer is unfortunately what has become known as hunting season. Every summer, there's traditionally a round of ceasefire violations, border clashes between Azerbaijan proper and Nagorno-Karabakh. What makes the recent escalation especially troubling is it was some 300 kilometers away from Nagorno-Karabakh. Ironically, throughout the duration of the skirmishes along the Armenian-Azerbaijani border, there was relative calm and peace along the line of contact or the area between Nagorno-Karabakh and Azerbaijan. What this represents, therefore, is an escalation in a new direction and a troubling new direction where there is a degree of pronounced frustration within Azerbaijan over the lack of progress from the peace process, undeniable and somewhat justified. However, it is how this frustration has manifested into a direct attack on Armenia proper. This is the real concern, showing the degree of danger, if you will, of escalation based more on miscalculation, but also on a calculation of frustration, a calculus that Azerbaijan is increasingly, let's say, giving up on diplomacy and resorting to force of arms. This is the basis of my concern and the foundation of real worry about not only how this could spiral out of control, but yet representing an expanded battle space, if you will, involving, unfortunately, not only greater willingness to use more offensive weapons, but the introduction of tanks, artillery, and even drone warfare. And finally, what we see is a very localized conflict that has great potential for broader regional instability, where Russia, Turkey, and even Iran are greatly concerned and perhaps in danger of interference or even intervention.
Yeah, we'll get to those broader regional concerns in a moment, but in an article for Ahval last week, analyst and academic Axel Kolu argued that though Azeri President Ilham Aliyev may be pushed by domestic concerns. As you mentioned last week in an Asia Times article, he would not have acted, Korlu argued, without the full support of Turkish President Erdogan. Korlu added that Azerbaijan's considerable military spending in recent years, including nearly $15 billion last year compared to the Armenian GDP of just $12 billion, this spending suggested Aliyev thought he might be able to grab some quick, tangible gains. I should mention the ties between Turkey and Azerbaijan have long been quite close, as both are Turkic states and Muslim-majority states and tend to be foes of mainly Christian Armenia. I should also mention the news today, which you, Richard, actually just shared with me via email about an hour ago, that Turkey and Azerbaijan will soon hold large-scale joint military exercises. So what do you think of this assertion from Korlu, particularly the idea that an increasingly internationally aggressive Erdogan may have been, to some extent, behind the Azerbaijani incursion, if that's what it was?
Well, this is a rare instance where I disagree with that Turkish analyst, who's actually personally a friend and professionally a colleague. My take is somewhat different. In fact, what we see over the past several years is a degree of Turkish frustration, and frustration by President Erdogan over the diminished role that Turkey once had as a military patron and big brother of fellow Turkic ally Azerbaijan. Russia, in fact, several years ago has outdistanced Turkey as the number one arms provider to Azerbaijan. And there's also a sense of frustration in Ankara over the role of Israel as a military patron for the Azerbaijani government. This, in my opinion, could be, yes, a green light from President Erdogan if we look at what's happening in Libya, Syria, etc., as an assertive campaign. But what it seems to be is Turkey trying to play catch-up, trying to use the escalation as an opportunity to regain a more prominent role as a military patron for Azerbaijan, and to somewhat distance or at least displace Russia as the number one key or player in this conflict. But at the same time, I think the Azerbaijani offensive and frustration is driven much more by domestic considerations. And Turkey is actually reacting and not as proactive in terms of either encouraging or promoting Azerbaijan, but rather trying to now exploit the opportunity or the opening, if you will.
Yeah, right. As you wrote, you mentioned both of these things in your piece in the Asia Times last week, that first of all, Azerbaijan was driven more by domestic concerns, and that Ankara, Turkey, was seeking to regain its lost role as Azerbaijan's main military provider, which it lost years ago to Russia. I thought that last point was interesting because just last month, Russia reportedly lost its pole position as the top natural gas exporter to Turkey and was replaced by Azerbaijan. For its part, Russia is allied with both Armenia and Azerbaijan and has offered mainly deafening silence, as you put it in your Asia Times piece. And let's not forget that while Turkey and Russia have drawn closer over the Turkstream pipeline, which was inaugurated early this year, and over Ankara's purchase last year of Russian S-400 air defense missiles, they also back opposite sides in the Syrian and Libyan civil wars, so their ties are rather complex. Please, if you would, give us your view on how Turkey and Russia are viewing this flare-up along the border. What might Presidents Erdogan and Putin might hope to achieve? And will this renewed Armenian-Azeri tussle spell trouble for Turkey-Russia ties?
Well, the short answer is there is an inherent return to the rivalry that historically has tended to mark the relationship between Moscow and Ankara. Mm-hmm. What we see on the ground and with this latest conflict is also a divergence where Turkey actually reacted prematurely, endorsing and if not supporting the Azerbaijani side, even prior to all the reports were in as to what exactly was happening, while as Russia, given its treaty obligations to defend Armenia proper in terms of being a member of the Collective Security Treaty Organization, the Eurasian Economic Union. It was Russia's inaction and timidity that was actually very divergent from Erdogan's full-throated response in support of Azerbaijan. What we see, however, is on the one hand, this marriage of convenience in the South Caucasus between Turkey and Russia is not only perhaps temporary and short-lived, but rather inherently unorthodox. And I think in many ways, Presidents Putin and Erdogan are far too similar, are far too alike. This is a clash of titanic egos in the past, when there was the Turkish downing of the Russian military aircraft, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And
in 2015.
I do think the region is much more prone to become more of an arena for competition rather than a shared sphere of influence for cooperation between Turkey and Russia. Having said that, I am in mourning for one casualty from this recent flare-up, and that is the demise and premature death of the outlook for the possible normalization of relations between Armenia and Turkey, something I've been working on for many years with senior Turkish officials. And I do think Turkey has become even more vulnerable and dependent on Azerbaijan's ability to limit Turkish options. So I think there's a triangle of aspects here, beyond simply Turkey-Russia, but Azerbaijan manipulating all sides in this conflict. And at the same time, from an Azerbaijani point of view, I think this is a reflection of unhappiness with the status quo over Nagorno-Karabakh, also Azerbaijan's very successful effort to derail normalization through the protocols between Turkey and Armenia, for example, something that Russia has been supporting in the past. So I do think the outlook is still murky and is still dynamic. And therefore, it's very hard to say how this will play out.
You talked of the possible normalization of relations between Turkey and Armenia, and that you've worked on that for a considerable period. Did you think that was a realistic possibility, say, a year or two ago? Is that possibility now lost?
Well, I do think on the one hand, the hard part over normalization is over. In other words, the real success was actually the signing of the diplomatic protocols between the Armenian foreign minister and then Turkish foreign minister Davutoglu. In other words, this was about normalization, not reconciliation. It was also stemming from a concession from the Armenian side of a policy of no preconditions, meaning that events of 1915, the genocide issue, were all no longer held out as prerequisites for border opening and diplomatic relations. My own meetings with former President Gül, as well as Davutoglu and the current foreign minister, this was a process on hold, but not necessarily dead in the water. And even if we look at Ibrahim Kalin, if we look at the Erdogan camp, there was a sense that a normalization is a national security win for Turkey to normalize the east of Turkey, for example, by opening the border. But at the same time, I do think Russia and Turkey may still hold the key to perhaps a return to normalization. But I think the challenge is neither in Ankara or Yerevan. The challenge in this context is directly from Baku.
In that Asia Times piece I mentioned, you wrote, quote, conflict is inherently challenging in a region where Russia, Turkey, Iran, and the West compete for influence and may usher in a new period of unpredictability and instability, end quote. We already talked about Russia and Turkey. The United States has offered little more than calls for de-escalation. Iran offered to mediate, which most see as unlikely, while the European Union initiated a phone call between the two countries' foreign ministers. What did it mean to you that the EU, which is generally seen as less of a player in the Caucasus than say, Turkey or Russia or even Iran, beat these regional powers to the punch?
Well, what surprised me was not only the rapidity, but the robust determination by the European Union to be more of a geopolitical actor on the ground. And this is more than, say, the Eastern Partnership. This was more than just, say, throwing money at the relationship. This mm-hmm. was an investment of diplomatic capital by the European Union. And I think it was a welcome contribution to a vacuum of diplomacy. And I actually expect more to continue, more to come from the European Union. Fortunately, from my perspective, living in Armenia, this is not about the United States, which has retreated from the region. And given the Trump administration's unpredictability, I think that's a good retreat for us on the ground. And it's also, unlike the Georgians, this isn't about NATO expansion or Western engagement, something much more realistic and much more acceptable for all parties, including Turkey, which increasingly is less of a NATO member, but also more acceptable to both Russia, Azerbaijan, and even Iran. Because even the Iranian offer of mediation was not serious, but it is a signal that Iran, in the wake of the collapse of the nuclear agreement with the West, is beginning to prepare to return as a regional player in the South Caucasus, another development that has implications for both Russia and Turkey in this region.
Mm-hmm. Switching tracks a little bit, much like Turks and Kurds, when violence flares between those two communities, tensions between Azeris and Armenians have been incredibly high all over the world in the past fortnight. An Azeri protest outside the Armenian embassy in London turned violent after Armenian counter-protesters arrived. An Armenian protest at the Azeri consulate in Los Angeles also led to clashes. An Armenian coffee shop was burned down in Kiev, with Azeris saying on Instagram it was their gift to Armenians. This past weekend, Azeris interrupted a group of Armenians performing a traditional dance in Harvard Square in Boston. And in Moscow, dozens of Armenians and Azeris have been arrested in street fights in the past couple of weeks. This deep-seated animosity goes back at least a century to the Armenian genocide, which you mentioned a short while ago, during which Azeris are said to have killed tens of thousands of Armenians in Baku and in Nagorno-Karabakh. This kind of thing continues today on a lesser scale. Last year, the art journal Hyperallergic reported that the Azerbaijani government has over the past 30 years engaged in a systematic erasing of the country's Armenian heritage, including the destruction of thousands of UNESCO-protected stone carvings. Richard, you're an Armenian and thus potentially somewhat biased in all this, but please, if you could give us some insight into the deeply rooted tensions between these two states, these two peoples. What's the source of it, and where is it headed today?
Well, what's interesting to me as an analyst, first of all, is the outbreak of attacks, of violence, of this kind of ethnic-driven animosity throughout the West in a number of cities, as you have mentioned, is a very troubling and depressing and distressing sign. Mm-hmm. It also shows the reason. Much of these attacks, these acts of violence on both sides, is a reflection of this new dynamic, because it was fighting between Azerbaijan and Armenia. This wasn't about Nagorno-Karabakh. Expressing much more concern and a higher emotional level. Mm. Having said that, what was reassuring was the reaction. There is, for example, a petition and an effort by civil society actors within Azerbaijan and Armenia together denouncing the violence. What's also interesting, within Armenia proper, there are no demonstrations against Azerbaijan. There is no rhetoric of war. In Armenia, it's just the opposite. There's concern and fear, a remembrance of the reality of warfare rather than some romanticized call for violence. And even unlike Azerbaijan, where demonstrators took to the streets and stormed the parliament, calling for attacks and violence, in Armenia, even the prime minister's wife has come out calling for peace. And secondly, as someone involved in track two diplomacy, even having visited Baku myself in the past, this is a time to redouble efforts on people-to-people contact, track two diplomacy. And in many ways, this is why we all need to denounce and not condone such violence on all sides.
All right, you mentioned no protests in Yerevan, but then in Baku, this massive protest that led to several hundred protesters storming into parliament, which Aliyev then called an attempted coup. In the Asia Times, you pointed out that every leader before him has either come to power or fallen from power because of military defeats. And you argued that all this points to potentially dangerous instability within Azerbaijan and a possible resurgence of Islamist activism, which reminded me of how Turkey just last week converted Hagia Sophia back into a mosque amid a surge of Islamic nationalism. Most observers see all-out war between these two neighbors as unlikely for a number of reasons, but it sounds like you, because of the instability in Azerbaijan, perhaps expect these skirmishes to continue or for the situation to at least remain explosive for the time being. I wonder how you think it might be calmed. Is it up to Russia and to Turkey? Might a post-Trump U.S. play a role? What do you think?
Well, that's a very good question, because from a military perspective, I'm a former instructor for the U.S. Army Special Forces. From a military perspective, I'm not worried about an official declaration of war or outright warfare. I'm much more concerned about a war by accident based on overreaction and miscalculation. Having said that, it pains me that today is a specific anniversary. Today is actually the 1,000th day of detention of a good friend, Osman Kavala, a peace activist within Turkey, prominent in Turkish civil society. It also reveals that in this region, including Turkey, moderate voices have been crowded out by more militant positions. And unfortunately, nationalism is again resonating. And in this COVID-19 crisis, it couldn't come at a worse time. Having said that, the reason I remain an optimist, and I wouldn't be optimistic unless I'm living in Armenia and actually have justifiable grounds, the reason I'm optimistic is what happened in 2018. A peaceful, very nonviolent revolution in Armenia that brought to power for the first time a democratically elected legitimate government. And this is a time for statesmanship over strongmanship. And I am a little bit optimistic that given the state of democracy in Armenia, given the lack of nationalist reaction, calls for war, the absence of such bellicose rhetoric, I do think that Azerbaijan will come back to the diplomatic table, only because the risk of the force of arms is so great for domestic stability within Azerbaijan. And I'm a little bit concerned that Azerbaijan has backed itself into a corner, but I do think that there's no alternative to diplomacy. And I do think that even President Aliyev is prudent and practical enough to see the inherent risk in such a battlefield gambit or gamble. So I do think at the end of the day, and perhaps even later this year, there will be a prudent return to diplomatic negotiations.
It's interesting that you say that, because there was kind of, one could say there was similar hope last year with the arrival of the new government in Greece. But then kind of an increasingly aggressive Turkey shifted the whole energy and dynamic. And now the two, there's again talk of all-out war between Turkey and Greece. And Greek officials as well are being doing a bit of saber rattling. So I guess you're more optimistic that kind but of Erdogan and Aliyev couldn't together kind of do a similar thing with Armenia.
But let me take it one step further. I think the problem with Greece, as the example, is it doesn't really apply, because the conflict between Armenia and Azerbaijan proper is rooted over the exclusion of the source of the conflict, the Nagorno-Karabakh representatives who need to negotiate with Azerbaijan. We're not Greece in terms of the problem in the Aegean is maritime conflict and energy in terms of the gas exploration and the Cyprus longstanding conflict.
But there are also disputed territorial claims, let's just be clear. Yeah.
No, but my point is that paradigm is much deeper, much older, and much more complex. Whereas Armenia and Azerbaijan, in some ways, are too similar, let's be honest, in terms of the dealing with 70 years of the Soviet legacy, dealing with the threat from Putin's Russia. And I do think we need more partners for peace. And unlike the Aegean, unlike the entrenched Cypriot conflict, I am more optimistic, yes.
Okay. Richard Yergosian of the Regional Studies Center, thanks for your time and insight. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Ahval podcastlerini tüm mobil telefonlarda Spotify, SoundCloud ve Spreaker üzerinden dinleyebilirsiniz. Apple iPhone kullanıcıları bize iTunes üzerinden de ulaşabilir. Türkiye'nin ve hayatın cıvıl cıvıl sesleri Ahval Podcast dizisinde. Kulağınız bizde olsun.